supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Every year, about 2.8 million teens run away and spend time on the streets. Every year, many never return home again. So why do many teens leave home? Some are thrown out. We'll learn more about that later. Some choose to leave home. Some leave home to find safety from abuse, freedom, or perhaps they're leaving simply to escape the chaos of a terribly dysfunctional home. That's the case with our guests on today's show. When Deborah Gwartney left her husband, taking their four young daughters and moving halfway across the country, she thought it was going to be for a better life for all of them, a chance to escape the turmoil of her marriage. Unfortunately, her two oldest daughters came to blame their mother for their broken family, becoming rebellious and withdrawn. And finally, in 1991, when her two daughters, Stephanie and Amanda, were 14 and 16, respectively, they could no longer stand this, and they left. They ran away, spending many months on the streets, leaving their mother in anguish. Joining me on the telephone is Deborah Gwartney, who's going to discuss her memoir, Live Through This. The book describes Gwartney's struggle with her two runaway daughters, her relationship with them before and after running away, and how they were able to heal. Also joining me on the phone is one of her daughters, Amanda, to talk about her own experience on the streets and why she decided to run. Later on in the show, we're going to hear from two folks from the Youth Emergency Services in Philadelphia. It's a local organization that provides shelter and services for runaway teens. But first, Deborah Gwartney, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
And Amanda, let's hear your voice.
Hi.
Hi, Amanda. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
So let me give out the phone numbers first. It's 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Deborah, you said in your book that the problem started with what you call an ugly divorce, but I'd like our discussion to start a little bit before that. Mm-hmm. Will you tell us about your marriage early on, what life was like for you, for your husband, when the girls were little?
Sure. We married very young. We were sweethearts in college, and I didn't realize it at the time, but looking back, I realized that I probably got married for all the wrong reasons. I was confused at the end of college about what to do with my life. I didn't really know myself very well, and it looked like, oh, I'll just get married and have a family. And I wasn't consciously thinking that, but I realize now that was kind of an underlying motivation. And, in your introduction, when you said that the marriage fell apart, it certainly did. But I think also what happened is that the marriage fell apart, and I went through a real crisis of trying to figure out who I was. And I think in that, that's where the kids kind of fell into the crack. I didn't know who I was as this young single mom of four daughters.
That was after the breakup. But I'm wondering, mm-hmm. before, it sounds like there was some identity issues then, too, who I mm-hmm. am, what do I want to be? And that's not unusual for somebody
right.
just graduating college. So
right.
how was it early on? Tell us about the man you married then.
Well, I think what happened with us is that we got married and immediately started having a family, and we spent a lot more time focused on our children than on each other. We just pretty quickly ran out of steam or interest in each other, and we just were so devoted to our kids, but that just couldn't hold up for long.
Hmm. Were there ever any good times?
Oh, sure, them? Yes, of course, there were good times, and we, especially when we did things as a family, I mean, we totally adored our children and did a lot of family things.
When did things start to unravel for you? When you look back, what were some of the beginning signs, times?
Well, you know, I was a stay-at-home mom, and when I decided I wanted to go back to graduate school, and I started making friends and became less interested in spending time with my husband, I found other people, not that I was having intimate relationships with just friends, and I just really felt alive and vibrant around this new life of being a journalist and going to school, and you know, that created a lot of jealousy and anger, and that was kind of the breaking point.
That was on his part, and it's when you say you felt alive outside of the marriage and in graduate school, it sounds like something felt deadening inside the marriage.
Absolutely,
at the
yes.
At the same time.
Yeah, it did. Not being a mother, I still, you know, I loved being a mom to my daughters, but I just didn't feel that's any link with my husband anymore.
How old were the girls? Just in the beginning, when you were in graduate school, when...
Amanda was, I think Amanda was 10 or maybe 11 when I was in graduate school, right around there. So, and they're all 2 years apart.
Amanda, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Amanda, when did you sense that things were going bad in the family?
I think I was about 9 years old, and we lived in Washington, and my mom wanted to go to graduate school, and my dad didn't want to leave Washington, and my mom wanted to move to Arizona to go. They started fighting a lot, and I remember my mom and dad fighting once and saying, my mom saying that she, if he wouldn't go with her, she would get a divorce. And that was the first time I'd heard that word in our house.
What was it like for you and your sister?
It was scary. We spent a lot of time up in our room playing Barbies, trying to stay away from the fighting.
Did you talk to each other about what was going on?
You know, I don't remember talking to Stephanie at all about it. I just remember kind of forming our own cocoon around it, away from it.
And that was separate from your two younger sisters?
Yeah, my two younger sisters, there's 3 years between Stephanie and Mary, so we kind of formed our own little mini unit.
Hmm. So no words were exchanged, but it felt like you both knew you were both caring for one another?
Yeah, and you know, we might have talked about it, I just don't remember.
What was it like for you, Amanda? Were you scared? Did you feel unsafe?
I never felt unsafe, no. It's always scary when something you feel like is going to stay the same forever starts changing.
Yeah, yeah. Deborah, tell us about the divorce.
Well, you know, I instigated the divorce, and my ex-husband really wanted to stay together and keep trying, but we went to marriage counseling, and we all, you know, at that point decided that we just had to be done with it. And, you know, at first it looked like to me we were going to be able to part without a lot of anger, but that just didn't last very long. It ended up being quite angry and scary for me, and the anger, the level of anger, and that's when I decided to start looking out of the city for a job, and I asked my ex-husband about it, and he said he agreed that maybe it was best that we live in different towns, but later he, you know, changed his mind about that. And I also feel very responsible for thinking if I just get away from this town and him that it's all going to be better, and I, you know, that was a pretty immature thought on my part, because I, of course, we just took all that anger with us, and it was just longer, farther away, but it was still there.
Your anger.
My anger, his anger, you know, and the girls were really caught in the middle of it, because we did such a lousy job of talking it out with each other that our daughters really got stuck in it. I mean, and, you know, and I have to admit that when we got to Oregon, I was just in the frame of mind of, we're starting over, girls, and, you know, it's only straight. We can only look ahead. And I just did not really think enough about what they were going through.
Amanda, tell us about when things started to change for you internally. Your mother talked about your dad drinking heavily when their marriage broke up. Were you aware of it? Were you watching it? Do you have any feelings?
No, I wasn't aware of it. Yeah, every once in a while he would wake up on our couch of the new apartment we had, and I wondered what was going on, but I wasn't aware that he was drinking, no.
Hmm. What happened to you as you began to change? I mean, we know about, you know, fires in the bathroom. I don't know if that was you and your sister.
Yeah, that was me.
The Mohawks.
Yeah.
Not that I want to cast aspersions against Mohawks, but it does make a statement. So what was going on with you?
Well, I guess the fire in the bathroom, hindsight's so funny looking back on it. It's hard to say why I did that. I was bored and restless, and it just got out of control, and I think that's kind of what happened in my life over those years. It just became, seemed innocent and small, and then it became out of control, and I just started snowballing into the person I became, I guess.
You felt out of control.
Yeah, I did. I felt out of control. Starting in the eighth grade after that fire, I think, was a turning point.
Amanda, tell us what that means to you, what that was like, feeling out of control.
Well, it felt like I was falling down a hill, and I couldn't climb back up. I couldn't repair what I'd done, so I just kept going.
Couldn't repair what you were done. So then it became about you. Were you trying to save yourself?
No, and I didn't. My mom writes in her book about my depression, and I think that had a lot to do with the attitude I adopted. I was incredibly sad, and I couldn't see past my own nose for a while.
Did you know you were sad?
I knew something was, I did.
You did? Because a lot of kids that age, a lot of kids are depressed and don't know it. They act on it, but they don't.
Yeah, I think after I acted on it is when I found out that's what was going on.
Mm. Deborah, I want to come back to you. You described yourself in the book as numb, and with each crisis with the kids, you became more numb.
Mm-hmm.
And numbness, you know, is a typical reaction to trauma or stress. It's adaptive. You know, it's healthy in the short run.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder about that mechanism of numbness in the face of stress. Did you use it in your marriage? Did you use it in your childhood?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I probably did. You know, that's not something I've really gone back and looked at. But I can say at the end of the marriage, that was definitely what I was feeling. And in fact, my ex-husband would say to me now and then, why are you so cold? You know, this is such an awful thing, and you seem so cold. And I thought, well, I don't feel cold inside, but I just feel like if I can just contain my feelings and not let them out, then this is just going to be, I'm going to be able to handle this. I kept looking around thinking, I've got four kids. I've got to keep this going. I've got to feed everybody and do laundry. And so I just didn't let myself have a lot of emoting at that time. And I think the strange thing when the girls started to get in trouble, I would completely fall apart and shout and yell and say, you can't do this. And then I would close down and be very, as you say, just numb. And it was a coping mechanism that I just didn't realize how it was exacerbating the situation, because I wasn't picking up on the nuances of what my daughters needed from me, because I was so frightened and panicked that I just, you know, Amanda talks about building a cocoon around herself and her sister, and well, I just feel like I built a brick wall of sorts that, and I just kept thinking to myself, just keep a normal life, just sustain a normal life, and we'll be okay. But that just wasn't going to work.
No, no. Amanda, what was the process of your deciding to run away? Was it a discussion you and your sister had?
Yeah, we discussed it quite a bit. We, it started when we were pretty young. We decided we were going to get train tickets or bus tickets to go live in Seattle and Portland. And at that point, we didn't know anyone who lived on the streets or who had ran away. All of our friends were still in high school. And we were just going to do it by ourselves and then figure it out when we got there. And we went and bought the bus tickets. And we left them at our house, and my mom found them and brought them to us at school, I think. We were at school still. And so that was the first time we talked about it. But like I said earlier, it just kind of snowballed into us leaving eventually.
Did you have a plan?
When we left?
Yeah.
No.
Was the thinking that you were going to leave permanently?
I don't think I ever thought that we would stay away permanently. It just, it started as a couple nights. It started, and then it became weeks and months. And
why did you leave?
Sorry, what?
Why did you leave? What is what is it you couldn't tolerate?
My mom gave us a lot of ultimatums, and she said, if you can't follow my rules, you can't live under my roof. And I just took it seriously, I guess. It was a constant state of stress that I couldn't bear anymore. I needed to find myself, and that was the only way I felt like I could have the freedom to find out who I was. And I know it was very unhealthy, but...
Well, did it feel like life and death?
It did, yeah.
Yeah. Stephanie, too?
Stephanie's very adventurous, I think. I don't think she ever considered it life and death.
Mm. But for you, it did.
Yeah.
We're gonna take a short break, and when we come back, I want to hear more about why you left, when you left, what happened out there, and we're going to bring in some other folks from the Youth Emergency Services in Philadelphia, because what I'm learning is your story is a powerful one and a moving one, but certainly not a typical one for kids who run away. So we're going to take a short break, and we're going to talk more about this. Our number is 888-477-9499. We've been talking with Deborah Gwartney and her daughter Amanda. Amanda and her sister Stephanie ran away in 1991 when they were 14 and 16 years old. Deborah chronicled this in her memoir, Live Through This, a mother's memoir of runaway daughters and reclaimed love. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Willie Little, who's Program Director for Youth and Emergency Services here in Philadelphia, and Bevan Gwiadowski, who's their Street Outreach Coordinator. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
Gratz College supports WHYY. The Gratz College Speaker Series, funded by Jewish Federation of Greater Philadelphia, welcomes home Rabbi John Cutler after 13 months at war. Rabbi Cutler will discuss the Jewish oasis he created as a chaplain in Iraq and offers an insider's view of what is actually taking place there. March 22nd at Adith Israel on the main line and March 23rd at Gratz College. Tickets available online at gratz.edu or 215-635-7300.
Van Morrison just released a live version of his 1968 masterpiece, Astral Weeks.
And that's the perfect opportunity for us to look back at a recording that combines rock, folk, blues, and jazz, one of the most unique albums in rock history. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. And this week on Sound Opinions, we conduct a classic album dissection of Van Morrison's Astral Weeks.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking with Deborah Gwartney and her daughter Amanda about Deborah's memoir, Live Through This, a mother's memoir of runaway daughters and reclaimed love. Amanda and her daughter Stephanie ran away in 1991 when they were 14 and 16 years old. I want to turn to Willie Little, who's program director for Youth and Emergency Services in Philadelphia. Willie, we heard from Amanda. We heard this very powerful and heartbreaking story about a marriage that falls apart, gets ugly, and the kids run away from a painful home. This is not your typical story of a child on the street, or is it?
No, it's not typically what we encounter at Youth Emergency Service. We work with about 375 youth a year who are runaway or homeless for various reasons. But we work with more youth who are put out or about to be put out of the home rather than kids who choose to run away. But we do work with kids who do actually choose to run away.
They're put out of the home. Why?
Usually there are issues and problems in the home and the family that have been going on for a while. And for various reasons, kids feel unsafe. Usually there are things going on like truancy, not following rules, not helping out around the house. And parents get angry, they get frustrated, and they may have sought some help from other outside sources, but they get to that point where they sort of, in similar situations, give ultimatums.
Deborah, did you seek outside help?
Oh, yes, a lot of outside help.
You gave these ultimatums. Were you ready to put them out?
No, I wasn't. No, I was extremely confused about how to handle it. We were seeing family therapists, and you know, the therapy got more and more intense as the trouble got worse. But it, you know, in fact, I think some of that therapy is what finally drove them away, because they thought if we stick around, I mean, Amanda could speak to this, but I think if they stuck around, I was just going to put them back in wilderness therapy camp or back into, you know, I paid for Amanda to live with another, or my family paid for Amanda to live with another family in Eastern Oregon where we didn't think she could run. And I think those things just actually made the girls more angry and more hesitant to stay home and try to work things out. So, you know, at the time I was in a panic, and any time an expert would say, well, try this or try that, I just would. But I don't think much of it helped.
Amanda, did that contribute?
It definitely did. Yeah, the first time we left, and my mom hired a private investigator to get us off the streets, and then eventually I ended up in the foster home. When I got back, I really wanted to work things out, and when they went back to the way they were with the fighting and the ultimatums, I ran harder and further to get away from it because I did not want to go back to any kind of a home.
When you said when they went back to the way they were,
when the things went back to the way they were.
Oh, things. Things. Deborah?
Yeah, well, you know, I think, you know, this is all in hindsight. I was a very panicked and frightened mother at the time, and I'm trying to forgive myself for not making great decisions, but I think that, you know, the girls went away to wilderness therapy camp and did all this kind of different therapy and lived with different families, and in so doing, we're supposed to face themselves. But there was never any demand on me to look at my role in it. And what I thought, I had this idea of what my family should look like, that I should have kids who went to school, who dressed in clean clothes, who, you know, did their dance and art. I just had this image of a family, and it frustrated me a lot when the girls would not fit into that image.
Well,
and
word,
again, this was not conscious.
Of course.
I realize now.
The word frustrated, here, as it filters through my psychologist ears,
mm-hmm.
Sounds like it could be shame or embarrassment.
Well, I was really, yes, I was quite ashamed that I had failed so severely as a mother, and I desperately wanted us to get back together and be a family that, you know, fit into our community. And you know, I consider myself unconventional in certain ways, but very safe ways, I guess. And I didn't have the imagination or the self-confidence to allow my daughters to express themselves in certain ways.
Deborah, did anybody pick up on your pain?
No.
The fact that you were out of control or felt out of control? Or both? Nobody picked that up. How much
pain? If they did, I didn't, you know, I couldn't hear it, I guess. You know, I just... No, I mean, I...
And did you know?
No, I guess I didn't, because I would get up in the morning and I would say to myself, I am handling this, you know, I'm going to work, I'm raising my kids, I'm making dinner every night, I'm, you know, nothing, I'm paying my bills, you know, I kept saying, as long as I can keep that together, I'm doing all right. But I just didn't let myself see that I was in a state of absolute panic in terms of, I mean, to the point where I wasn't functioning very well.
It is amazing what sustained stress does to a body, a mind, a mm-hmm. brain. I mean, you didn't know what was going on outside or inside.
No, and when I would go to the police, they'd say, sorry, it's not against the law to run away from home. We can't help you. And I would go to shelters, and as your other guest was describing, and they'd say, sorry, we can't tell you if your children are here. We're here to serve the children and not the parents. And so I had a great deal of trouble finding anybody who would say, we're going to help you find your kids.
Amanda, when you left, did you have any expectations of what life would be like on the street?
No, I didn't have any expectations. At first, I had worked all summer, and I had a lot of money saved up, so I thought, well, we can run away and Stephanie and I can get our own apartment and we can start our own life. And then those dreams kind of fell right. through as I was only 16 and couldn't get a job or an apartment.
Right. So what did happen on the street? What was it like?
Well, we traveled around, hopped trains, hitchhiked, slept in abandoned buildings and parks, panhandled. Occasionally, we ate at shelters, but we never utilized the shelter system.
I don't want to put you in an awkward position. Are there things that took place on the street that you won't talk about?
No, there's nothing that took place there, except I don't like talking about other people very much because I don't feel like it's my place, but I won't talk about anything. There's nothing I won't talk about that happened to me.
So we know you got involved with heroin.
Yeah.
On the streets.
We did.
And we also know that a lot of kids sell sex for money.
Yeah, I never did that.
Or get raped. You were never raped or abused?
I was never raped, and I never sold myself.
Hmm. Let's turn to you, Bevan Gwiazdowski. Did I get the name right?
Gwiazdowski is close.
Really hard for me. So let's talk about what happens to kids on the streets. I mean, I wonder if Amanda's story is typical or no.
I mean, her story is and it isn't. A lot of our youth that we see have been sleeping in parks and abandoned buildings. You know, they get involved with drugs, whether it's in, you know, trafficking, trading, or using, or all of them. But another thing that tends to happen for our youth is they don't immediately go to the streets. They're often able to stay with friends, with family, and, you know, couch hop or surf. So that's one of the reasons that this population is so difficult to find sometimes, because they're kind of invisible in that way. And they're able to maintain fairly regular lives and still attend school if they want to, and, you know, hang out with their friends and basically keep this a hidden secret.
That's amazing. That's amazing talent and really speaks to creativity and really one's life force. You know, couch hopping. I mean, that's really says something about these kids, about their abilities.
They're survivors. They really are.
How about the ones who are on the streets?
Well, I mean, life for them is obviously potentially a little more difficult and dangerous. You know, trading sex for money isn't the only thing that happens. You trade sex for a place to stay, for a place to be warm, for food. It's essentially survival sex. Anything that you need, that's an easy way, you know, to get it. And I've recently spoken to a young woman who was telling me her stories about how that was what she was doing to survive. And, you know, she sort of is detached from it. And that's just one of the things that can happen.
Deborah, Amanda, I want to talk about anger. We touched on that early on. I want to talk about how anger works in the family, how it was expressed or how it was repressed. We heard a little bit about, you know, your ex-husband's anger, Deborah, but I want to hear about yours. What happened when you got angry? Amanda, what happened when you got angry?
Well, I think now that I look back on it, my cycles of anger were to have big outbursts and then to completely withdraw and just be, you know, huddled in some kind of confused mass. I remember feeling confused most of the time. Just, it didn't feel like any path was going to lead me to a resolution, and that kind of just constant turmoil. I mean, I took my anger out on strangers. You know, I was always mad at the driver next to me or the grocery store clerk for going too slow. Or, you know, I didn't realize till years later that I was just angry at everybody.
And the girls.
And the girls, for sure.
And yourself.
Oh, yes, definitely myself. I'm still pretty angry at myself about all of this.
Is forgiveness possible?
Well, you know, writing the book really helped me a lot, and having Amanda and Stephanie read the book, and we finally talked about things we'd never talked about before. And, you know, I guess it was my way to tell them how sorry I was in some ways.
Did they forgive you? Well, I'll ask Amanda.
Yeah.
Did you forgive your mother?
I have forgiven my mother, yeah. It took many years, and I think it took her forgiving me, too.
Yeah, that was my next question. Debbie, you know, you said that you were threatened by your daughter's desire for autonomy. Mm-hmm. Why was that?
Well, it goes back to my, you know, unformed sense of self. I had these four beautiful daughters who are just, was so enamored with them and as little girls and how they reflected back on me. And, you know, it's that old cliche that I didn't really know where they ended and I began. And I just so identified with them that it was rather startling to me when they wanted to have their own lives instead of the lives that I'd imagined for all of us. You know, these weren't kind of my conscious thoughts again, but this is what I've realized in writing the book, that I way over-identified with my kids.
Yeah, I've got to ask this question. I'm a psychologist, so I can't not ask this question. I want to know about your childhood. I mean, you've said several things. This ability or need to kind of close your eyes and shut down your feelings, and you know, this lack of identity when you emerge. So, what was it like when you were a kid?
Well, my parents were 16 and 17 when I was born, and I was the oldest of five. So, you know, I had a lot of adult responsibility when I was a kid. We were all kind of the same age. I figure, as we were growing up, they were very young parents.
Yeah, so you really didn't have any guidance.
Yeah, very little guidance.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk more about runaways on Philadelphia streets and what happens to them. And I also want to talk about what happened after Amanda and Stephanie came back. That's also not a really pretty picture. So we are hearing from Deborah Gwartney and her daughter Amanda and her sister ran away in 1991 when they were 14 and 16 years old. Deborah wrote about it in her memoir, Live Through This, a mother's memoir of runaway daughters and reclaimed love. In addition, here in the studio, we have Willie Little and Bevan Wiadowski. I know I messed that one up again. They're from the emergency services here in Philadelphia, and their website is ysiphilly.org. We'd like to hear from you at 888-477-9499. If you've ever run away or have had a child or a loved one that's run away, give us a call. 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
The National Constitution Center supports WHYY and presents the world premiere of America I Am, the African American imprint, now through May 3rd. This exhibition celebrates nearly 500 years of African-American contributions to our nation and portrays the courage, conviction, and creativity of the African-American story. Tickets and information for America I Am, the African-American imprint, are available at www.constitutioncenter.org.
A new report on how to deal with home foreclosures has just been issued by the Congressional Oversight Panel. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Elizabeth Warren, who chairs the panel, about what they found. Warren is Leo Gottlieb Professor of Law at Harvard Law School. She also is helping monitor how the federal bailout money is being spent. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking with Deborah Gwartney and her daughter Amanda about what happened, 15, 17 years ago in 1991 when Amanda and her sister ran away from a dysfunctional family and lived on the streets. Deborah's written about it in her memoir, Live Through This, a mother's memoir of runaway daughters and reclaimed love. I'm also joined here in the studio by two people from Youth Emergency Services here in Philadelphia. It's a local organization that provides shelter and services for runaway teens. Willie Little is their program director, and their outreach coordinator is Bevan Gwiadowski. And our phone number here is 888-477-9499. Deborah, getting back to the title of your book, So what is it like to live through this? Tell us about those months when the girls were gone.
Well, yeah, they were horrible. And the last time the girls left, and Amanda was gone for 3 months, and Stephanie was gone for nearly a year, at that point I had realized that I was completely drained of money, and I have programs. I felt like I had tried everything that all the experts had suggested, and still they were gone. So at that point, I realized the girls have to choose to come back, and I think that was a good realization for me to make. I worried about them every single day. It consumed me and my younger two daughters, but I also kind of released myself from the active looking that I had been doing, the sending out of posters and flyers and making all the phone calls. I thought, you know, they're gone, I don't know where they are, and they're going to have to choose to come back. And it was a very maturing moment for me in some ways. I didn't have control.
Did you have support?
My younger two daughters were tremendously supportive. And around that time when the girls were gone, I became involved with my now husband, and he was tremendously supportive. Mm. So those were the three people who really held me up, and a couple friends.
Tell us about the impact of all this on your younger daughters.
Well, you know, they really were worried and missing their sisters and confused, but I think both of them, Amanda could maybe speak to this better, I think both of them feel like they gave up some of their childhood to take care of me during this time. But, you know, the girls are all very close now. The four of them have a great friendship together.
I'm listening to your story, Deborah, and I want to turn to Willie Little. Here's a mother in anguish. Are there any services available for parents of children who've run away?
Well, in Philadelphia, there are some prevention program services that we refer families to help after they may have used the shelter services. But we always work with the families when we're in the process of uniting a, or reuniting a child or adolescent with their family. Hmm. So we may provide some family counseling for a short-term basis.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Marie on the line. Marie,
hi. Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What can we do for you?
Well, I'm calling in. I happen to be home today listening to your program, and it really touches a nerve in my system. I ran away from home when I was 15 years old, and I'm 48 now. And I'm still quite affected by it.
How so?
I came from a very abusive family. I was one of eight children. I was sixth in line. And my father was a very abusive man, and my mother sat back and kind of watched it happen. And as I got older, the abuse became more severe, and I left.
You lived on the street?
I lived, which I didn't know it had a name, but I guess it was couch surfing for a while. And I was always a very mature-looking young lady and an attractive person. And I think that helped me out a lot. I was able to get employment when I was 17. I met a boy who was, or a man who was 4 years older than me, and I started living with him and his family. And I pretty much was in that relationship for about 7 years. And then I left that because it was an abusive relationship.
Marie, tell us about the scars. You said you're still affected. This is 30 years later.
Yeah. I think my scars are with my mother and father. We really don't have much of a relationship. I love them very much, but I also I struggle with all of their really bad choices, and my father has yet to just say, I'm sorry. It's just been too difficult for him. I think for him to apologize and to recognize his abuse and the fact that it chased me out of the house is too much for him.
So if I understand, the scars you're talking about, the effect is about your anger, resentment towards your parents. That's what you're carrying.
Yes, the anger and resentment, but at the same time, I love and need them more in my life, and that's where I struggle. They don't communicate a whole lot with me. I think they're afraid of perhaps hearing my feelings more than what they want to.
Of course.
And so I think that that's kept them at a distance. What we have are two parents and a child who love each other but have had so much harm and so much hurt that we just haven't been able to swim through it and meet up with each other.
Yeah, that's a lot of scar tissue to get through. Well, just for your interest, Webster defines forgiveness as letting go of resentment. It's got nothing to do with the other person at all or the behavior. It's just letting go of resentment, and boy, do I wish that for you, and I wish it for you certainly while your parents are still alive, so that those scars can be diminished. Thanks so much for your call, Marie. This kind of pain that we're seeing, Willie, I imagine you see that pretty often, this kind of family pain.
Families are going through a lot, and it's really kind of a typical story to hear what Marie had to say.
Can you tell, and I guess I'll turn to you, Bevan, can you tell which kids are going to do better in the long run and which won't?
That can be tricky because sometimes you can have youth who present, you know, they seem to know exactly what's going on, where they're headed, they have goals, they want to get there, and then when they get to that point where they're about to take that next big step, they completely self-destruct and, you know, will do something that could potentially, you know, prohibit them from taking that big next step. But then you have some kids who come in and, you know, you think, oh, this kid is just never going to get this together. You know, they have so much going against them. And then they just make little steps in progress, and it's amazing.
Amanda, when you came back home, things were not pretty in the immediate aftermath of your returning home, yes?
No, they weren't for years.
Years. At what point did you change the way you felt about your life?
Well, it happened really slowly. I think when I was 20, I finally realized that I needed to go to college. So I went to Prescott College and moved away back down to Arizona and really discovered a lot about myself there. And then moved back here, back to Oregon, and got pregnant. And while I was pregnant with my first baby, my mom and I pretty much healed our past scars then.
How?
You know, I got so introspective when I was pregnant, and my mom was writing this book at the same time. So we talked through it a lot. And I think we forgave each other then.
You don't remember a point, Amanda, in your life where you decided you don't want to do this anymore?
I had a lot of those points, and then I would rise up out of it, and then I would self-destruct again. So the last time I decided I didn't want to do that anymore was probably when I was about 20.
What got you there, that final one? Did you have help getting there? Did you have help deciding? Were there possibilities in your life that you hadn't seen before?
Well, as I said before, I struggled with depression a lot, and I did start seeing a counselor. I was on and off antidepressants, which really didn't help me, but they did help me get my head out of the hole it was in. And yeah, I saw the possibility. I saw myself getting older, and I needed an education. So I wanted a better life. I wanted to be active and successful, with not successful in a job sense, but successful in a living sense.
Life sense.
Yeah.
I want to ask you, Amanda, and you, Deborah, you've both talked about feeling regret. And I'll start with you, Amanda. In that home that you lived in, at that point in your life, what do you wish you had done differently?
I wish I could have seen the bigger picture more. Once I had my child, I realized how much I squandered. I wish I had been more independent and not without having to destroy my relationship with my mom, but I wish I had followed through with some dreams and traveled the world instead of just the country in a destructive way.
So you've got no regret about leaving. You just regret about the perspective you left.
The way it happened, yeah. I don't wish I traveled the country or the world when I was 15. I wish I had been able to stick it out and travel the world when I was 18.
Right. Deborah, how about you? Going back to that point in your life, what do you wish you had done differently?
Well, I guess I'll say exactly what Amanda said. I wish I could have seen the bigger picture. You know, all I could see was that we were falling apart, and I couldn't seem to make any move that was making it better. You know, I there wasn't a day that I stopped loving my children, but I stopped listening to them and in my own panic. And I wish, you know, Amanda often says that teenage girls just have to feel powerful, and I wish I had found a way to make my daughters feel powerful and to feed their sense of adventure without, you know, that they're having to jump on a freight train.
What would it take? What do you need for you to forgive yourself?
You know, it's happening slowly, I think, and I really liked the quote you gave a little while ago about resentment. I was cooking with all four of my daughters in my kitchen not long ago, and we were talking and cooking and laughing, and I just suddenly stopped and I thought, wow, I don't know why, but the anger is gone. It's just dissipated, and it made me feel like forgiveness has its own timeline, own evolution.
Yeah, it's like grief, and it's very, very similar to grief. We've got to close, but I'll close with my favorite quote about resentment. It comes from Rabbi Harold Kushner, who wrote "When Bad Things Happen to Good People." He said, "Resentment is like mud wrestling with a pig." He said, "You're both going to get dirty, but the pig's going to like it." I want to thank you all so much for joining us. Deborah, Amanda, I appreciate you taking the time. Deborah, thanks so much for having the courage to write this book, and I wish your whole family continued healing, love, and happiness.
Thank you.
Willie Little, thank you. And Bevan Gradowski, you got to change your name. It's making me crazy here. I want to thank you both. He's the program director for Youth Emergency Services in Philadelphia, and she is their street outreach coordinator, and they can be reached at ysiphila.org. Next week on Voices in the Family, we'll be talking about our returning troops and PTSD. Well, you can reach us at voices@whyy.org. And you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer for radio content at WHYY. Our executive producer is Mike and Scott. Voices in the Family is produced by Gita Simons. Elisa Walters is our associate producer. Our intern is Jonathan Glick. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Have a good week, my friends.